The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Lots of empowerment today. My guest in 30 minutes will be Gary Brivlin. He is an award-winning journalist talking about the institutionalization of money lending to capitalize and bilk those in poverty, how we exploit poverty in the United States. And these are the very people who've been going onto Capitol Hill with their lobbyists, have been close with the legislators, and wait till you see what they get away with. This afternoon at 3 o'clock, a really in-depth show on the real environmental cost of coal, the single largest source of greenhouse gases, and can coal really be clean? The president says yes, we say no. Peter Bull, award-winning producer for PBS Frontline and director of the Center for Responsible Reporting, will do us the service of sharing with us why we have been lied to, how we've been lied to. Tomorrow at noon, we will be once again taking on those who promote the Senate food bill, thinking it's a good idea, like Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, totally misguided, totally wrong. And we will challenge S-510 as one of the worst pieces of legislation in American history. My guest, Attorney Scott Tipps. He is the strongest voice in America advocating against Senate Bill 510. It's a bad bill, and shame on the left for once again not having any sense of scholarship or even irony that it is promoting the absolute unmitigated interest of the most greedy and corrupt corporations in America. Then later in the week, we will talk with how the Reagan Republicans and the Clinton Democrats shifted the social agenda in order to enrich Wall Street and mug Main Street with one of our nation's most important journalists, Robert Scheer. Needless to say, this is the one radio program in the world for independent and progressive minds. Also today, since Barack Obama will be talking about how we're going to start the process or have started the process of leaving Iraq, no, we haven't. It's all game. I'll share with you the people's story. For example, 9 years later, Afghanistan looks much the same, a mess, tad raw. The U.S. has lost in Afghanistan. We have come to grips with that means by, that will be from Con Halliman from Foreign Policy and Focus, U.S. Wars, People versus the Generals by Marwan Bishara. U.S. occupation in Iraq more than doubles poverty, sickness, and leaves the country in total disaster by Adele Shamu from Foreign Policy and Focus, spinning the U.S. failure in Iraq, and that's what the president will do today, and we'll challenge that, and 10 steps for Obama to start dismantling America's gigantic and destructive military empire. So I will get to all these commentaries over the next several days. Also on today's program, in about 10 minutes, 10 ways your taxes pay for environmental devastation. From highways and SUVs to paper mills, you'll get a real update. But let's always begin, as we do each day, with the latest on health and healing. This is a good report. And by the way, I'm not in New York, hence you can't see me in the studio because I'm way far away from New York today and will be for some time filming and doing special investigation. We have seen from a new study that the fruits, in particular the berries, have an ability to slow down the aging of the brain. Let me read this from Ethan Huff. It says, the aging process involves a steady decline in the brain's ability to guard itself from oxidative stress and inflammation. New research has found that certain compounds in fruits like blueberries and strawberries and acai berries not only help the brain to stay in tip-top shape, but they actually help to reverse the damage effects of aging. Now, when functioning properly, the brain continually works to clean up and recycle various toxic proteins that get lodged in the brain over time. These proteins contribute in a bad way to cognitive dysfunction and overall memory loss. And sooner or later, you end up with Alzheimer's. Well, the powerful berries exhibit demonstrated benefits in helping the brain to clean up these bad proteins and improve overall nerve function. Quote, the good news is that natural compounds called polyphenolics found in fruits, vegetables, and nuts have an antioxidant anti-inflammatory effect that can protect against age-associated decline, unquote. And that's according to Polus, PhD, head of this particular study. Quote, in aging, the cells responsible for brain maintenance fail to do their work and debris builds up. In addition, the microglia become overactivated and actually begin to damage healthy cells in the brain. Our research suggests that polyphenolics in berries have a rescuing effect. They seem to restore the normal housekeeping function, unquote. Well, how about that? So for all of you who have been using two particular products, Red Stuff and Berry Blast, you're way ahead of the curve on that. Good science catching up. Another thing I mentioned last week, why cranberry was effective in helping stop urinary tract infections. This is from the national meeting held just this week of the American Chemical Society. And from the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, they reported that cranberry juice helps prevent bacterial adhesion, thereby once again showing that you are less likely to have urinary tract infections. And in women in particular, that can cause severe pain and urinary urgency. Now, urinary tract infections are most often caused by E. coli. That's a strain of bacteria that exists in the lower digestive tract. And the bacteria enter the urethra, which is the opening through which urine is excreted and migrate upwards into the bladder, and in some cases the kidneys. E. coli adheres to other bacteria of this kind, forming what is known as biofilm. And biofilms enable bacteria to survive, multiply, and resist eradication. Well, the good news is that anywhere from 2 hours to 8 hours after consuming a cranberry juice cocktail, that cranberry juice is able to prevent the adhesion, and that, hence, prevents this. But let's go to even a more basic idea. The idea that the vast majority of urinary tract infections come from E. coli, from the rectum. Well, how do you get from the rectum to the urethra? It's simple. You wipe instead of wash. Amazing as it may seem, with all of our technology, Americans simply are unclean. We really find it difficult to come to grips with simply washing with soap and water. You don't need the antibacterial soap because, quite frankly, almost all the studies show that regular soap does just as well as antibacterial soap. Just wash yourself thoroughly and you wash off all the E. coli and you don't have a problem. Wiping, all you do is smear it around, and then when you're perspiring and walking and sitting, it migrates. The E. coli moves. They're living organisms. They move and they come down to the urethra and they enter the urethra. It's that simple. So one way to stop the suffering. And by the way, mentioning suffering, tomorrow I'm going to be responding to a New York Times front page story yesterday by Gina Collada about how nothing is working with Alzheimer's. Really, Gina? Well, we are going to make a challenge to the New York Times and ask you to interview Marie McGovern, a woman who 2.5 years ago, you're right, New York University, Rush Center, nothing worked. Columbia University, Alzheimer's Center, nothing worked. Neurologist, meds, nothing worked. Until a natural approach that did. Same approach that helped Kenny reverse and completely eliminate his multiple sclerosis and Thomas to overcome his Parkinson's. And, well, let's just see if the New York Times does anything about it. With a little encouragement from us with phone calls and letters and Marie actually going over there with our film crew and going in the New York Times and see if we can get by their security to speak with the woman who says nothing works. We'll confront the New York Times tomorrow. But one thing that they are saying, and this is the latest study that's out, that Alzheimer's is getting into people's brains earlier. That's right. Used to be, you had to be older, like a senior citizen. Not now. People in their 40s and 50s are now showing Alzheimer's. 40s and 50s? Yeah. Well, that's not old. Unless your lifestyle is one that promotes sickness, and then, of course, then you are old. Fruits and vegetable supplements show promise against the common cold. This was a very good study, and again, you won't see this in any of the newspapers, but it was done at Charité University Medical Center in Berlin, and it was published in the British Journal of Nutrition by Stephanie Roll and her team. And what they found was that when they took some supplements, fruits and vegetables only, not vitamins or minerals, just fruits and vegetables, and they made it into a powder, and they gave it to a group of people versus a double-blind placebo-controlled, so no one knew who was getting the powder versus the placebo. And they did this for 8 months. And what they found was that those who received the fruits and vegetables did much better against the common cold than those who got the placebo. So this new German study shows your fruits and vegetables in concentrated form, gee whiz, there again, way ahead of the curve, you've been using your concentrated fruits and vegetables, your greens and your reds, but this is showing that one of the reasons you're not getting colds, well, because they did the study showing that you didn't get the same incidence of colds, and that was in a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial published in a peer-reviewed journal. And finally, there's a rice that's called the forbidden rice. I don't know why it's called forbidden, but historically rice was always white, and because they wanted to show the purity. So all the good qualities of rice were milled out. Those were given to the peasants. So the royalty in China ate white rice. But there was a hidden rice, forbidden rice, and it was the black rice. And it was well known in ancient China. Well, now we see that this black rice, rich in anthocyanins and antioxidants, is right up there beside, you bet, blueberries. That's right, blueberries and blackberries, as far as providing antioxidant benefits. Quote, just a spoonful of black rice contains more health-promoting anthocyanins and antioxidants than are found in a spoonful of blueberries. And, quote, if berries are used to boost health, why not black rice and black rice bran? Well, I would agree with that. And for those of us who eat different types of rice, red rice and yellow rice, because there's different colors of rice depending upon where it's grown, the soil's grown in around the world. One last one. Crohn's disease is really easy to deal with. It is not a challenging condition. For mainstream medicine, of course it is. But for the rest of us, it is not. Here's the latest. This is from the peer-reviewed journal published by the British medical journal, GUT. It shows that broccoli and banana fibers are very important. That's right. Broccoli and banana soluble fibers increased by the emulsifier polysorbate 80. Quote, this implies that dietary supplementation with such fibers might have a protective effect against Crohn's disease relapse by preventing bacterial invasion of the mucosal, unquote. That was done by Dr. Rose of the University of Liverpool. So, broccoli, yep, eating it, great for you, also prevents cancer. But in this case, it's the fiber that was good for him. Who knew that broccoli fiber was so healthy? I'm Gary Nall, again, bringing you the science from peer-reviewed literature, always citing the science, always having the references, posting these articles up on GaryNull.com so that everyone who chooses to can make healthier choices, knowing that good science is behind it. And this is not the stuff you read in the papers. This hasn't been vetted. This hasn't been censored. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Over the next 5 days, I'll be sharing a group of commentaries from different individuals, this one from Adil Shamu from Foreign Policy and Focus, that challenges the White House and Congress spin that somehow our surge is won in Iraq and we're withdrawing and the country is a better place because of it. We brought our form of democracy and stability and we got rid of the tyrant, etc., etc., etc. Iraq has between 25 and 50% unemployment, a dysfunctional parliament, rampant disease, an epidemic of mental illness and sprawling slums. The killing of innocent people has become part of daily life. What a havoc the United States has wrecked in Iraq. UNHABITAT, an agency of the UN Habitat, I should say, an agency of the United Nations, recently published a 218-page report entitled State of the World's Cities 2010-11. The report is full of statistics on the status of cities around the world and their demographics. It defines slum dwellers as those living in urban centers without one of the following. They don't have durable structures to protect them from the climate, meaning housing, sufficient living area, sufficient access to water, access to sanitation facilities, and freedom from eviction. Almost intentionally hidden in these statistics is one shocking fact about urban Iraq populations. For the past few decades, prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq 2003, the percentage of the urban population living in the slums of Iraq was just below 19%. Today, under George Bush and Barack Obama, we have managed to raise the amount of people living in abject, total, complete poverty to 53%. In fact, 11 million of the 19 total million urban dwellers live in abject poverty. In the past decade, most countries have made progress towards reducing slum dwellers, but Iraq has gone rapidly and dangerously in the opposite direction, thanks to the United States and our members of Congress. According to the U.S. Census of 2000, 80% of the 285 million people living in the United States are urban dwellers. Those living in slums are well below 5%. If we translate the Iraq statistic to the United States context, 121 million Americans would be living in abject poverty in slums, complete ghettoized. If the United States had an unemployment rate of 50%, that would be almost 121 million people living in slums, you can bet riots would be everywhere. The military would take over and democracy would simply evaporate. Not that we have much of a democracy as it is. So why are people in the United States not concerned and saddened by the conditions in Iraq? Why is it the President of the United States today will get up there and, as he always does, act charming and say how good we have been to the Iraqi people, how we brought all these great things to them, and not once show a picture or mention anything bad, and not one single one of the reporters in the room will dare challenge him that everything you're saying is self-serving and only a part of the picture? Because most people in the United States do not know what happened in Iraq, and what is happening there now. Our government, including the current administration, looks the other way and perpetuates the myth that life has improved in post-invasion Iraq. It is not. Our major news media reinforces this message. They lie. I had high hopes that the new administration would tell the truth to its citizens about why we invaded Iraq and what we're doing currently in the country. President Obama promised to move forward and not look to the past. However problematic this refusal to examine on the past, particularly for historians, the president should at least inform the U.S. public of the current conditions in Iraq. How else can we expect our government to formulate appropriate policy? More extensive congressional hearings on Iraq might have allowed us to learn about the myths propagated about Iraq prior to the invasion and the extent of the damage and destruction our invasion brought on Iraq. No amount of money that we put there will make a difference. Adil Shamu is professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Now, 10 ways your taxes pay for environmental devastation. Oh yeah, urban sprawl, you bet, pollution, overconsumption, deforestation. Like it or not, the U.S. taxpayers, meaning you and me, are still paying for all these things to occur in America and beyond. And despite recent investments in green jobs and technology, an array of government subsidies pay big, dirty industries like coal, oil, and factory farms to destroy the environment in every possible way, while greener, healthier industries that we talk about, like solar and vegetable farms, get a pittance or nothing. Let's take a look at the top 10 real quickly. Highways. When gas prices rose dramatically in 2008, Americans began flocking to mass transit in droves. That's a good thing, resulting in declining revenues for the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Naturally, the Bush administration's response was to put more money into fast trains that could go 300 miles an hour and take more people safely. No. No, that's not how they would think. Instead, they did the obvious thing. They paved with gold, as it's stated. Billions of dollars are pumped into highway systems every year while encouraging the polluting car culture that leads to further sprawl while mass transit continues to fall by the wayside. Number nine, in case you aren't already taking optimal advantage of the polluting power of our nation's sprawling web of highways, the government would like to make your impact even greater by setting up you in a gas-guzzling subsidized SUV. A portion of the tax code revised gives business owners a huge deduction for up to 30% of a large vehicle's cost, which can add up to about $25,000 in the case of a Hummer, which to me looks like a little shoebox, far more than the credit given to individual purchasers of energy-efficient vehicles. You only get the credit if it seats 9 passengers, weighs over 14,000 pounds. So the bigger your car, the less mileage per mile it gets, the more it pollutes, the more our government subsidizes you. Then we have paper mills. Paper mills cut down trees while sucking up massive amounts of fossil fuel and get big money from the government to do it, all through a loophole in the law that was supposed to benefit renewable energy. A law enacted in 2005 contains a section that gives businesses an incentive to mix alternative energy sources with fossil fuels. To qualify for the tax cut, paper companies started adding diesel fuel to black liquor, a pulp-making byproduct that they were already using to generate electricity on its own. But time might be running out for this egregious misuse of taxpayer money. The unemployment extension bill, approved by the Senate and on its way to the House, would eliminate this loophole. But it's there until it does. Then commercial fishing. About half of the $700 million in subsidies given to the U.S. fishing industry directly contributes to overfishing. That's right, too much fishing. According to a new study by the Environmental Working Group, the subsidies, which equal about a fifth of the value of the catch itself, lower overhead costs and promote increasing fishing capacity, meaning more fish are caught than are naturally replaced. How much? 25% more. The nuclear power. Nuclear industry's decade-long $600 million lobbying effort, that's right, they paid $600 million to lobby and buy off President Obama, who agreed to grant loan guarantees for nuclear power plants. Obama has been promising since the early days of his campaign that he would find a way to, quote, safely harness nuclear power. Well, thus far, he has given $55 billion of your money in loan-backed guarantees for more uranium mining and the storage of radioactive waste. Factory farming. You saw the big recall of all the polluted eggs. That's just one extension of that factory farming out there. And American factory farms are literally filthy cesspools of their own making. And who else is cleaning all that up? You bet, United States taxpayers. That's right, giant factory farms make up just 2% of the livestock farms, and yet they raise 50% of all the animals, and we pay for the cleanup. How much is that? About $125 million a year. Then corn ethanol, to quest to beat back fossil fuels, cleaner fuels that we can grow, seem like a good idea. It's not. It's stupid. Corn-based ethanol gobbled up 76% of federal government renewable energy subsidies, leaving little for wind, solar, or geothermal. And by the way, what's worse in my opinion, it's a huge drain on water resources. You use 2,138 liters of water per single liter of ethanol. It's just stupidity. But we do it anyhow. And then processed food. Ethanol isn't the only product that comes to us courtesy of U.S. corn subsidies. There's also plenty of processed food products with multiply subsidized ingredients, wheat, sugar, soy, and of course corn. And gee whiz, we pay for all that subsidies with our Farm Bill subsidized program. Coal. You've heard of how much money we give coal. Well, the coal industry spent $47 million on lobbying last year alone. And as a result, they continue to be allowed to pump greenhouse gases, carcinogens in the air, and turn my Appalachian home area into post-apocalyptic hellholes. Coal subsidies have survived. No one touches them. Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. How much do we give these people that pollute? $115 million last year. And finally, oil. Climate change brought to you by the U.S. government. According to a study by the Environmental Law Institute, fossil fuels received, you ready for this? $70 billion in subsidies in just a six-year period, 2002-2008. Yep, that's it. They just keep getting the money, even as they make the money, and even as they pollute the environment. I'm Gary Noll. That's that. Let's go over and say hello in studio to Kara Lee before we're going to go to our guest in about 10 minutes. But let's say hello to Kara Lee first. Hi, Kara.
Hey, Gary. How are you doing this afternoon?
Going great.
All right. Well, I have an email here. It's from a professor in England. I believe he has sent you a couple emails before. He said his wife was listening about 6 months ago or so, and you were talking about chivalry in relation to knights and the round table. And you also were talking recently about Jane Austen, and he posed an interesting question saying, what is the relationship between the history of chivalry and how did that play into the life and times of Jane Austen?
Oh, well, that's a stretch. Okay, Jane Austen, that was a long time ago I answered someone's question on Jane Austen. All right, let me see if I can make sense of this and at least make it meaningful. About 1,400 years ago, in the 5th century, there was alleged to be a King Arthur. And it was King Arthur who created this beautiful, pure place of gallantry named Camelot. And it was filled with knights of courage. His mentor was a man named Merlin, who was a magician. He was a heroic king, and it was the perfect society. Why was it perfect? Because there was complete equality. And why was it perfect? Because they sought the highest virtue in how they dealt with each other and the rules that they would establish. And Arthur was unique in that he was considered not some untouchable king, but rather a person of the same qualities and failings as most humans. Against the advice of Merlin, he married this woman named Guinevere. And she was rescued by the bravest of the lot, a lot of knights called Lancelot. And Lancelot and Guinevere became lovers. Now, Merlin had predicted this and predicted the decline of Camelot. Now, Camelot only lasted for one lifetime, the lifetime of Arthur. And mind you, this was at a time when there was no King Arthur. There's never been a recording in history of a King Arthur. There was, however, a battle. And the battle was in the 5th century between the Celts and the Saxons. And the Saxons invaded and the Celts won. And Arthur was the person attributed to winning this battle as a warrior. Now, around 410, the Romans left Britain and to fight the invading Nantes. And that left the Celts to defend Britain. And it was in the middle of the Dark Ages. There was high infant mortality. People did not benefit from centralized government. There was no centralized government. In fact, there was no central society. There was no central power. It was all broken up into tiny little groups of power people. And that's how it was. Then, 700 years later, you had a man in 1138 named Geoffrey of Monmouth, and he writes about King Arthur. It was a book called The History of the Kings of Britain. And why did he write this? Well, no one knows for sure, but a lot of the book was devoted to this King Arthur, though there was no King Arthur. There may have been a warrior named Arthur. Mind you, this is long after Arthur's death. But we believe it was because the grandson of William the Conqueror, who was real, and he was the king at that time, the grandson, he wanted to be known as coming from a heroic background, of something noble, of something that was unique and above reproach. And so it was at this time, and from prison, as we believe, in one of the first best-selling books after the printing book started, that Geoffrey had this book that became a big bestseller. In fact, one of the biggest-selling books in England. And that's why, in effect, he wanted, that the King of England at that time wanted to create a background that showed a lineage back to this most noble of all men in the history of England, Arthur. And the key in this particular book was to build what would then be a whole series of books that would build upon something like chivalry, where you all took an oath for perfect behavior. And this was then followed by, in 1470, by Sir Thomas Malory, who wrote a novel and on all this. And then it was Lord Tennyson who wrote the final evolutionary piece of this and The Idylls of the King. And that's when they got into the Round Table. Now, mind you, from the very beginning on, not all the characters were in place. So each book suddenly introduced someone new. And then suddenly you had the Round Table. Well, it wasn't until the 15th century when Henry VIII actually built a Round Table. But it couldn't possibly have been the original Round Table. Why? Because the original Round Table in King Arthur was supposed to have seated about 150 people. Well, just imagine a table that seated 150 people and it was round. You'd have to have a gigantic space to put that. But all this meant one thing, that the story of Arthur was about the story of virtue. And this, in the 12th century, they tried to legitimize the story. And they talked about Arthur had a father, Uther, who seduced another nobleman's wife, and that's how Arthur was born. And then they introduce in another chapter, in another time, much later, the Lady of the Lake after, later on, and that Lady of the Lake all gives Arthur Excalibur, the great sword. And as long as he held the sword, he would never lose a battle. And keep in mind, all the knights sitting at the table were equal. None was superior to the other. And all this supposedly happened around Canterbury Castle. Well, there's no Canterbury Castle there now. There might have been something, but there isn't now. And but then again, they said there was no Troy. But they've now found seven separate settlements that they consider Troy. But then they added one last thing, and that was the quest. The quest meant that you had to go out and at the highest ideal of life, you had to seek a quest for something that was eternal. You had to triumph over fear, triumph over evil, triumph over selfishness, triumph over greed. You had to use all your resources to rescue the truth. And what was the most important quest in history? Kara?
I don't know, Gary.
The Holy Grail. The chalice that held the Holy Grail. And what was in the Holy Grail? What was the Holy Grail?
It had something to do with Christ's blood, right?
Yes, it was the blood of that was on the robes of Christ. And then they introduced the final character was Prince Galahad. And his whole life was meant for living as a spirit, and sitting at the round table with all the other princes, suddenly appeared the illusion of the Holy Grail, and only he had the capacity to find it. And it was Sir Mallory who created Galahad, who was the illegitimate son of Lancelot, and because Lancelot had fallen from grace. By the way, he would die allegedly as a pauper, as Guinevere would die in a nunnery. So then the son attains the Grail. But in the process of attaining the Grail, the highest virtue, there was nothing yet else to live for, hence he dies. And then Guinevere and King Arthur were buried together, but not in Glastonbury. Then Joseph of Arimathea, who was the one who supposedly founded the Church of England and brought the Holy Grail there. This is all about the fall of Camelot, the idols of the king. And then you had a poet laureate who was Alfred Lord Tennyson, who brought the final part to this. Now, that brings us up, by the way, in the final battle of all this was that an illegitimate son of Arthur comes to do battle with him, thinking that he's weak, and Arthur kills him, but is inflicted with a mortal wound and goes to the Isle of Avalon, and where he then demands that his sword be returned to the Lady of the Lake, and then he dies. And so that is the end of that. But what happened at this time? Well, when Alfred Lord Tennyson was writing this, Queen Victoria was just coming into this new realm. They feared the Industrial Revolution. They feared science because science would challenge the myths that they'd all been living by. Science would prove that the Earth was older than the Bible stated. But all societies had their myths. All of them. In fact, it was 500 years after Buddha died that the first writings about Buddha appeared. I'll deal with that on a separate occasion. They did not want something that did not have some sense of purity. Now, take it to Jane Austen very quickly. Now, Jane Austen's well known. I mean, Pride and Prejudice, Emma, Persuasion, Sense and Sensibility, Northanger Abbey, what else? Gentry, Cassandra, and Mansfield's Park. But what did she do? Just imagine the time she lived. She was born in 1775. I believe she died around 1817. She didn't live a very long life. But my goodness, a lot was going on when she was alive. When she was alive, Queen Victoria was just ascending the throne, going through the Gilded Age of then. And they would hold these virtues of the gallantry and nobility and country first, a clear up to the First World War. And she was an observer of the court. She wasn't in the court, but she was close to many people who were in the court. This was a time when you had George III. He married Princess Charlotte. They had 15 children. Only one of those children actually ended up having a child that could be considered legitimate, so he only had one legitimate child. They thought he was mad, the madness of George III. He actually lived to be about 81 years old. 40 years on the throne is a long time, especially if you're a nut job. And all of his sons went broke. And if you were immoral at that time, you were supposed to hide your immorality. You had great men. You have John Wood, the architect of Bath. You had John Nash, one of the greatest architects in the history of Europe. You had Christopher Wren, the 17th century architect. You had the 18th century architect Rococo, Robert Adams, Thomas Baldwin. These are some of the greatest architects, Gothic architecture, and they were reviving those old architectures. So imagine by the Royal Pavilion, the neoclassic look, and John Nash, all that you were reviving historical things from Rome, Greece, India, the Indian pavilion that John Nash did. And then you had Beau Brummel. Have you ever heard the clothing store Beau Brummel?
No.
Well, it was based upon this Beau Brummel, who was really a kind of a high couture man. He was a fashion titan, and he was a gambler. But all these people would get together, and they would go to a place called Bath, which was a place where if you had money, you went and you gambled and you socialized and you did that. She observed all this. So she was the interloper observer, and she would write about the manners and morals. For example, if you wanted to show that you had arrived and yet you had no title, you would be able to gamble. And so as long as you had money to gamble, you would go and gamble. And the more you lost without complaining and thinking as if it were nothing, the more people would say, did you see how much he lost? Did you see what his wife was wearing? Did you see how many servants they had? So in her Sense and Sensibility, she talked about the codes of conduct. She talked about courtship and the choices that people made in their conduct. She was that rare individual who had the brains and the intellect to dialogue all this. At the same time, you had earlier, you had The Rights of Man by John Payne, dedicated to examining what was going on in the world. You had a lot going on in France. You had a lot going on with French Revolution, 1789. French Revolution broke out, 1792. You had the nine-year war between France and England, 1775. You had the war broke out in another war in England. She was alive during all that. She was looking all that. She was aware of the William Pitts, the prime minister. She was aware of all that was going on at court, all that was going on in the upper society. And that's what she wrote about. The great William Wadsworth and Alexander Pope and James Thomas Gainsborough, the painter, and Joseph Reynolds. So when you're at the heart of something, remember what it would be like if you were a gadfly in the middle of the 1970s, where you could hang out with Truman Capote and Andy Warhol and Dennis Leary and the socialites, and you could write about them. Well, there was one guy who did that, Thomas Wolfe. And in effect, Thomas Wolfe was very similar to what I would consider Jane Austen. Hope that answers your question.
Thanks so much, Gary.
Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's standing by. I want to thank him for standing by. He is Gary Rivlin. I introduced him earlier in the program. I'll do it again. He is a journalist who wrote daily as the tech editor for the New York Times. He has covered the Silicon Valley and regularly writes for Newsweek, Wired, East Bay Express, Salon, New Republic, and the American Bar Association Journal. And he's won dozens of journalism awards for business and financing. And he also has written four books, including The Plot to Get Bill Gates, and most recently Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty Incorporated, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Nice to have you with us today, Gary.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you two questions and just run with them. I won't interrupt you. I just really appreciate your insights on these. First, petty lending. We'll call that fringe financing or alternative financing that leads to what you call poverty incorporated. How predatory businesses are set up in poor neighborhoods. That's a big business. That's $40 billion a year industry. And they prey off the poor. And these are your pawn shops and quick check-to-cash operations and loan sharks. How has this become institutionalized and the role that the large banks have played in promoting this and the lobbyists in Washington to keep these predatory practices thriving? And one problem is that these payday lenders charge very high interest rates, sometimes in delinquent fees up to 400%. Could you go through this, please, to tell us a problem that most Americans are unaware of?
Right. So there's all these various ways that entrepreneurs and big businesses have figured out how to make money, big money, off the working poor. We've had pawn shops for centuries, check cashers date back to the 1930s. But since the 1980s and the 1990s, there's been all these, for lack of a better word, clever ways that they've come up with to get rich off the, you know, those making $20,000, $30,000 a year struggling to get by. So you got rent-to-own. That's the industry, an $8 billion a year industry of renting people their furniture by the week or the month. You've got payday lending. There's $40 billion in payday loans a year. And in fact, what you said is true, that, you know, the fee you're paying for what's a two-week loan works out to an interest rate of 400% or more per year. So there's this wide range of businesses, and they became huge not just because there were such good ideas, but because they've got funding from banks. I mean, funding from big-name banks. Just to stick with payday lending, Wachovia, Nations Bank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, that's a partial list of the banks that funded the early entrepreneurs who wanted to get rich off payday lending. Payday lending only dates back to 1993. These are short-term cash advances against your next paycheck. Morgan Stanley, one of the most respected investment banks on Wall Street, they took public the largest of these payday lenders, Advance America. So you could go topic, but you could go product by product and see that the big name brand banks played a big role. The instant tax business, this idea that you can not have to wait 2 or 3 weeks for your tax refund, but you could get it tomorrow, but for a fee that works out to an interest rate of in the triple digits. You know, HSBC, the huge London bank, JP Morgan Chase, another huge bank, H&R Block, these are all companies huge in that area. And, you know, what's sad about all this is all these businesses, the pawnbroker who's making a, you know, $100 loan to you against your watch, your TV, whatever you bring in, the payday lender that's going to give you a $200, $300, $400 advance against your paycheck. If people had only $500 in savings, poof, those businesses would go away. But that's the problem, that, you know, wages are stagnating in this country in the last couple of decades, while meanwhile prices of rent, of heating oil, of health care, of a long list of things goes up and up and up. And so if you got a family of four and you're living on $30,000 a year, with each passing year it gets harder and harder and harder to put aside any savings. It's harder and harder to make ends meet. And, you know, the end of the month is coming up and you don't have enough to pay it, you go to the payday lender, you go to the pawnbroker. And so there are these businesses in these communities that are pretty much helping people stay poor. I mean, who's the person who could least afford to pay a 400% a year interest rate? It's a single mom with two kids working as a waitress, but that, in fact, is who's paying. What really, really troubles me about these businesses, I mean, there is a need out there, right? I mean, people need short-term money. If you need, your car breaks down, you need it to get to work, you don't have the $300, what are you going to do? The problem really comes down to the profit margins these companies are making. Until recently, the payday lenders were making profit margins of 20, 25% or more a year. I mean, you know, typical banks dealing with conventional customers, they make single-digit profits. So it became this opportunity to get really, really rich off those living on the margin. Subprime credit cards, you know, that those in the subprime credit card business, they're making profit rates at 2 or 3 times that of those in the conventional credit card market. Yes, those customers are riskier. You have damaged credit, you're a greater risk. But what I'm saying is they take into account the risk and then build in a lot of fat so they can make a lot more profit.
You would think that in our society, knowing how much people are suffering, that there would be some effort to curtail the type of late fees and penalties that can take that interest rate way over 100%, making it virtually impossible for anyone to ever get out of debt, but then they keep taking the money, so pay us $10 or $20, whatever it is, a week, forever.
Yeah, but you get deeper and deeper and deeper. As a woman in Dayton, Ohio, some of the book takes place in Dayton, Ohio, just to give it a sense of a place. The woman said that, you know, a payday loan is to bridge a gap, but the problem is the gap gets wider and wider and wider. You borrow $300, you're going to owe $345 in 2 weeks. But the same person who's so desperate for $300 today, how are they going to have that extra $345 above and beyond their usual bills to pay it back in 2 weeks? So people just roll it over and just keep on paying this same huge fee for weeks and months on end, or they borrow from store B to pay back store A, but then owe store A and B and have to go to store C, and then you have this problem with people owing 3 or 4 or 5 stores at once. The Congress did pay some attention to this in the financial reform legislation that President Obama signed last month. The consumer advocates were thrilled that this legislation creates a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And for the first time, there's going to be an agency within the federal bureaucracy that puts consumer financial protection first. Every other agency puts the safety and soundness of the bank first, and, you know, on the side we'll deal with consumer complaints. And that's giving hope to consumer advocates, but, you know, the devil is in the detail. I mean, who is the president going to choose to head this agency? What kind of regulations are they going to have? And it's also not a panacea. I mean, largely when we're talking about check cashers, pawnbrokers, payday lenders, they're regulated by the state. So here in New York, you can charge, it's about 1.8% of the face value of a check to cash a check. But if you happen to live in Arkansas, let's say, it's 5% of the face value of a check. And think about it. If you're making $20,000 a year, you don't have a bank account because you messed up your relationship with the bank. If you're here in New York, you'll pay $400 a year in check cashing fees. But if you're in Arkansas, you're going to pay $1,000, in fees, you know, off that $20,000. And one-third of the states in this country have no cap on check cashing fees. And so what I wish we could do is have a national debate about this. And like, wait a second, so check cashers in New York are doing just fine. They're making plenty of money charging 1.8% of the face value of a check. What's going on in Arkansas that this person could get away with charging 5% of face value? I talked to a guy in Wichita, Kansas, where there is no cap. He's a check casher there, and he's charging as much as 10% of the face value. So part of the problem is that this is regulated by the states, and there needs to be further federal intervention if we're going to have some sense of equality and fairness here. Like, okay, you're paying for a service, cashing your checks, taking a short-term loan, but there needs to be limits on the amount of profit that these big companies can charge.
You're listening to Gary Rivlin. I'm going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. Continue listening to this interview over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Gary, these practices would not be able to exist if there wasn't heavy lobbying in Washington. What are the banks doing to keep these lending practices in place? And what are some of the primary predatory practices being used in low-income neighborhoods to bilk our poor population?
Yeah, so hey, one thing to keep in mind about, you know, just to stick with payday lending, most states have a usury cap, that is, a limit on the interest rates that a lender can charge. And the way that payday lenders took hold in the 1990s is they spent millions and millions of dollars on campaign contributions and lobbyists going state to state to state, getting exemptions from existing usury laws. So, you know, here in New York, I think it's 16 or 18% is the usury cap, typically is 28%, 36%. And yet here the payday lenders could charge 400% or more annual interest rate, and that's because they got an exemption. Some states are changing their mind. In recent years, Ohio, Oregon, a couple other states took away the exemption that they'd granted to the payday lenders. But, you know, once you grant an exemption, it's hard to take it away. And as far as the banks battling in Washington, D.C., I mean, they scored some victories with the financial reform legislation that just passed. But they also lost some battles. I mean, it was a mixed verdict for everyone involved. And, you know, on the Wall Street front, there were lots of disappointments. We still, in the late 90s, we took away this wall, this firewall between investment banks, regular banks, and insurance agencies. And it wasn't, and that caused so many of the problems we had with the subprime mortgage meltdown. That wall wasn't returned with financial reform. So there are lots of disappointments on the Wall Street front. But as far as consumer protections, there's serious credit card reform, which the banks are really unhappy about. There was a lot of great reforms when it comes to mortgage lending. Of course, it was a little too late given what happened in 2008. But the Congress did pass legislation that eliminates some of the worst abuses that went on in subprime mortgage lending, so we can now assume that the next time we have a crisis, it won't be subprime mortgage lending, it will be some other fancy financial instrument that Wall Street has come up with to get around existing laws. But, you know, I have to give Congress and the President credit that I think there were some really sensible consumer financial protections that were finally implemented that consumer advocates have been asking for 10, 20 years. I mean, I think some of the frustration in this book was you had people as far back as the early 1990s who were trying to get those in power to recognize what a huge problem subprime mortgage lending was becoming, that all these lenders were making loans without taking into account a person's ability to pay back the loan. And they saw the disaster that was in the making, but no one in power would listen. The only time Congress elected officials finally listened to what was going on is once we hit the crisis. I mean, that's so typical. But, you know, in states around the country, in Washington, there are all these community organizers, consumer advocates, who were saying we need to bring some sense to the mortgage market. There's all this abuse going on in the inner cities and rural areas that have fallen on hard times and working class neighborhoods. All these people are being put into loans with 10, 15, 20% annual interest rates. They're losing their homes because these are abusive loans, and yet no one did anything about it for the longest time.
Last question for you. When you look at inside of most of the urban areas where many of the poorest have to live, you won't see the big health food stores or farmers markets. You won't see the cultural centers, rare exception. But you do see an awful lot of places. You just drive up 3rd Avenue at 100th Street, 122nd Street, 126th Street, and you'll see whole stores, buy all your furniture, rent furniture, and then you don't realize for a poor person that doesn't have any money but wants furniture, needs furniture, that may be the only option they have. What's that cost them? Could you take us through that and how the cities, inner cities, are just a honeycomb of exploitation?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that, but I do want to correct one thing, that yes, the inner cities have the rent-a-centers, and the inner cities have the Jackson Hewitt, those are the instant tax places, and the inner cities have the check cashers, but so do the white working class communities, so do the first ring suburbs that have fallen on hard times, so do rural areas where, you know, whatever the part of the country, the logging jobs, the other jobs have fled. That, you know, 10 years ago, this was more of an inner city issue, but there's been so much money put behind it that it's no longer an urban issue. It's just wherever there are people living on the margin, that's where you're going to see all these businesses.
Okay, you're right. They're going to wherever people are desperate.
They're going wherever they're desperate. Let's use rent-to-own. The brilliance of rent-to-own is they have figured out how to sell a TV that would cost you $900, let's say, at Best Buy, for $2,000. And, you know, not surprisingly, Rent-A-Center, it's a $3 billion a year company, the biggest of the rent-to-own, they're making a profit margin much, much higher than Best Buy is making because they're making so much more from each TV. I mean, they have more expenses. They're collecting weekly payments. You know, if a person has a problem with a TV, a couch, whatever, they have to deal with it. But with that said, they have a lot of revenue. They have a lot of room to be making money. So the thing that I would tell somebody, like, hey, instead of paying for a TV by the week, you typically pay for 18 months. Instead of paying for the week, you know, you can save up that $900 and get it for much cheaper just by going to Best Buy. The problem is, a person who's living on 20 grand, 30 grand a year, how are they ever going to save up that kind of money? And I wish I could just, with a magic wand, eradicate those businesses. But to be fair about it, you know, someone works as a chambermaid at a local hotel in Times Square, is barely making any money. They want to come home and sit on a nice couch and watch their TV, and this is the only way they could do it. I mean, these businesses are providing a service. The problem is it's a very, very expensive service and arguably an unfairly overpriced service.
Well said. Gary Rivlin, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate what you've done there. The book is Broke USA. Website, Gary Rivlin, RIVLIN.com. All the best to you on this project.
Thank you very much, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. In 2 hours, we're going to take on, what are the real environmental costs from coal, the single largest source of greenhouse gases, and can coal really be made clean? Peter Bull, award-winning producer for the PBS Frontline and director of the Center for Responsible Reporting, will talk with us about these issues and how, every time you turn around, we have the President of the United States supporting clean coal, enormous subsidies to clean coal, and clean coal allowed just to destroy Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, parts of Pennsylvania. How they get away with it? Because of lobbyists. We'll deal with all that. Have a good day. Stay tuned for The Natural Nurse.
Feels so good. You're lying here next to me.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.